That comes up about every 5 years. I'll get a phone call from a magazine or someone writing an article and be like, men don't believe that women have a sense of humor. I don't know if we need to put up plaques in different places or there need to be monuments. It's something that it keeps reappearing. And I think it's in the same way that we have to be reminded to eat vegetables on a regular basis, or that fiber is good for you, or that pets can help you live longer, or that violence is an issue in relationships and that is not a good thing as a way to solve problems. It's really astonishing to me that we need to be reminded of this. And I do think that women's humor is very different from men's humor, and that's what I've spent the 35 years of my life writing about the topic. And it does change. I think things have changed in the time that I've been looking at it. But it does seem as if the point has not quite stuck in a way that it continues to surprise me. I'm happy to give basically the same idea because what we see represented in humor is still mostly male comics. If you look at a lineup, for example, at one of the larger comedy venues, is at Mohegan Sun or Foxwoods, it will still be mostly male comics. You will see the five people appearing that week, and they'll be mostly men. Occasionally, there will be one woman on the list. But if they put, and this is something that I've learned from people who do this for a living, if they put more than two women comics out of five, it will be considered a girls' night. The male comics are all considered individuals, but women comics are considered part of the same group. As if women are not individuals, they are just part of a type. The same goes for comics of color. It's astonishing how much we still live in a world where the straight white guy is an individual, but if you're any part of a marginalized community, you are supposed to represent that community. Yep. And you are not considered an actual original individual person, but simply a place marker that will represent that group. Not that I'm bitter, really, because why would I be?
Plug your book title right
yes,
there.
Yes, one of the book titles is It's Not That I'm Bitter, but it's really sort of astonishing to me that that's the way it works. And something that I'm very proud of is that I'm the only full-time woman academic to be a member of the Friars Club, which is this still very old boy network of comics, of entertainers. And it is a world where the old ways of doing business are still very much modeled on the guys going to these comedy clubs, performing. They hang out in what are called comedy condos. A lot of women do not want to be in the comedy condo. It's a way of going through life that is not welcoming to female performers. And so the ones who do it, I have enormous admiration for. I think it's a very tough gig. And I've never done stand-up comedy. I do a lot of speaking engagements, but I have a two-book rather than two-drink minimum for my audiences.
Not so much a question, but that all reflects that, you know, we've thought that women have come so far in our society, but there are these constant reminders that we just haven't.
Right. That would be the same thing with people arguing that women have caught up in terms of, let's say, paychecks.
Right.
And that is wrong. It's
false.
Simply wrong. It's false. And it's one of those facts that people continue to be surprised about and argue with as if it's not a fact that women are still making, I think it's 22 cents less per dollar mm-hmm. than men. And that's looking at educated
right.
women.
Right, and not to mention women of color.
Right, exactly. Not to mention the terrible jobs that many women have no options but to accept. And the disparity in something like a paycheck is amazing. And then we justify it by saying, oh, but they don't want it. They're still not as ambitious as men. Or, look, they take time off to have children. you know, unless actually your water is going to be breaking, you know, in the corporate example. Yeah, you're going to take the day
right.
off. Really, when you give birth, you want to take a day, day and a half. And really, this is what we're going to do. So there are many reasons, but it's as if women are to blame still for our own repression. And that gets annoying. Shall we just say it just gets annoying after a while?
At least annoying.
Yeah, yep. At least annoying.
So what I love about you is you talk about these very deep issues, not only this type of thing, but you talk about in your columns your mother and her struggles with mental health and anxiety, things like that, your relationship with her, your mother, body image things that women know all too well. People think of humor sometimes as being kind of frivolous, but you've made this career of really studying it and understanding it and then writing about things with this humor lens. How do you kind of thread that needle?
I think that's a lovely question, because I do think that the best humor, and not just women's humor, but perhaps especially women's humor, has always dealt with taboo subjects. Mm-hmm. Humor can confront, and the best humor always has confronted, the worst possible topics. What humor does is to deal with topics that nobody else wants to touch. And so it deals with sex, it deals with death, it deals with money, it deals with trauma, it deals with misery, it deals with discomfort. If a comic is not making somebody uncomfortable, that comic is not doing his or her job. And because what you're supposed to do with comedy, and Mark Twain talked about this, Aristophanes talked about this, Sarah Silverman talked about this, is you make the comfortable uncomfortable and you make the uncomfortable comfortable, so that you switch around the balances of power, that those who believe they are in a position where they're secure are made antsy, and those who are anxious and nervous are made to recognize that they're not alone, that other people feel exactly that way. Mm-hmm. And so by talking about what's meaningful in life, what comedy does is to emphasize what's significant and not dismiss it. It sort of run towards the things that we're most afraid of, as opposed to backing away. So it might be frivolous. I mean, I love the word frivolous, actually, because it literally makes light. It sheds light. But what it does is it sheds light on the dark corners of things. It takes things out of the shadows and makes them the center of discussion. But it never trivializes. The best comedy doesn't trivialize. It emphasizes, it italicizes, it makes us remember and understand something from a different perspective. And that's why it's important. And that's why it's always been part of every culture. Every culture has a version of the comic and uses humor. It is a fundamental human expression and way of thinking.
So how does this jive with this whole cancel culture thing? In one of the videos I was watching of one of your talks, you said how women can have a great sense of humor and also assert their power by not putting up with offensive jokes. So is it that people can only joke about things they've experienced? How do you feel about that?
Humor, at its best, doesn't attack what's vulnerable or weak or defenseless. And so humor that's going to be original, that is not just a repetition of nastiness, that is not something that is designed to shut somebody up, is never something that we have to worry about. Humor that is a gag is a whole different category. Because think about the word gag for a minute. Because a gag is a joke that's played on you, but a gag is also something put across your mouth so that you shut up. And when humor is used to silence somebody, to make somebody feel awful, to make somebody feel that they have no right to speak, to make them feel as if they are displaced out of the conversation, then that's not useful. And that doesn't mean that you have to whine, cry, or call a lawyer. What it means is that you have to come up with an even better response. If somebody tells you a joke, not only that you don't find funny, but that you actually find painful, that you find offensive, and you can find something offensive not only on your own behalf, but on somebody else's behalf, you can say, if you forgive me for not laughing, I'll forgive you for telling that joke. And that way you're not up all night, you know, because most of us, when we hear something like that, we're like, you know, awake at 2 o'clock in the morning going, I should have said this and I should have said that. Where if you learn how to say something quickly, even if it's only to express like, you know what, no, I'm not so happy with that little exchange we just had. So maybe you need to understand that you just said something that doesn't work for me. And you might need to rethink saying that to somebody else. And you have the strength to say that. And you have the confidence to say that. And you can say it in a funny way. It allows you to keep your sense of self and not be erased. because the worst kind of humor makes people feel as if they're diminished, silenced, or erased. And so learning how to use humor, not as a weapon, but as a tool, learning how to turn it back on somebody almost as a way of sort of martial arts, gives you a sense of power. And that's really important.
When did you first know you were funny?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and on Ocean Avenue. So if you're not funny growing up in Brooklyn, they'll kill you. So it was really a very basic survival tool. I grew up next door to Judge Judy, who has remained a friend. And Judy Shineland, her father was the dentist. He was the dentist, Murray Blum. And Murray Blum would put you in a seat, and my family was very poor, and he used to give us dental care for free, which was really nice. I'm very glad I still have good teeth. That's because of Murray Blum. And when I see Judy, what we do, people say, what do you talk about? You talk about, politics. We talk about old stories from the neighborhood, but that her father was hilarious. What he would do is put you back in the chair, stuff your mouth full of cotton, stand over you with a live drill, and tell funny stories. And you were not going to disagree with Murray because he had a live drill over your mouth. But the neighborhood really was funny, and it was a real mix of people. It was all different ethnicities, different versions of life, different classes of people. And it was a real mix. But you had to talk fast. You had to learn how to tell a story as efficiently as possible to make sense. You were playing to a demanding audience there. You really did. To have to be heard, you had to come up with a good line pretty quickly. And so I think anybody from my block really was funny. I have an older brother. He's hilarious. We still make each other laugh. And the whole thing was, it was very deadpan. There was not a lot of playfulness. What it was really getting that line that you found the gap in somebody's argument or the pretentiousness that somebody was trying to show off or whatever it was, and you just got that little thing, or you found the anomaly on the block, or in one of the columns I recently wrote, it was about the fact that my grandmother made turkey for Thanksgiving, but she also made 23-course Italian meal. So like making the turkey was basically just to prove that she was a naturalized citizen.
Right.
It wasn't like the real meal. It was there to prove, like, if the immigration people came, that she actually had her citizenship papers. And then what's amazing is that with the columns, then dozens of people write in from around the country going, we did that too, except we were Polish, so we made kielbasa and pierogies, or we were Lebanese, and so we made baba ganoush on Thanksgiving. What you realize is that when you tell the truth, that's what's funny. You don't need to invent jokes or make something up. All you need to do is pay attention and write it down. That's really the key to the whole thing. And of course, none of this is what I do in my classes. People are always asking, are you funny in class? And I'm occasionally funny in class. I think my students would agree to that. But I'm a very tough teacher. I don't teach courses on humor. I teach modern British literature. I teach Victorian literature. I teach courses on the femme fatale. And this last semester, I had a wonderful class, particularly one of those classes that really clicked. And it was on loneliness and literature. And that's the topic of my next book. And I think it fits very much with the idea of humor, because, again, it's about telling the truth. It's about people's real stories. It's about looking, again, at the parts of life that people don't bring out into the open, and why it's important to examine those and to discuss them collectively with meaningful conversations. We're reading The Great Gatsby and Butterfield 8 and The Bell Jar. It's not like a laugh riot,
no.
To do this. But there are moments where, of course, the humor breaks through, and in conversation with the classes, it comes out. So it's an interesting mix.
So when did you figure out that you could kind of juxtapose your studies of literature and feminism and humor?
I think it was when I was doing the work for my PhD. I knew the only way that I was going to be able to actually write a dissertation, the most daunting part of the process, was going to be if I focused on a topic that I actually liked, mm-hmm. not just, everybody comes up, you're dealing, as my graduate students do over the years, you come up with something that's interesting that hasn't been done 10,000 times, where you can do original research. So I had my professors at the Graduate Center of City University, where I got my degree, and they were saying, well, you could do working women in the novels of Charles Dickens. And I'm like, yeah, I could. I could. You know, I knew how to write a paper. I had gone to Dartmouth College and Cambridge University, and I mean, I knew I could perform. I could do that stuff. I was a good student. I was always a good girl. I've abandoned that project, but I started out as a good girl. And then I thought, no, if I'm going to actually sit down and write 250, 300 pages on a topic, it better be something that captures my imagination. And so I did my dissertation on hate and humor in the novels of 20th century women writers, because I decided that those were the two parts of any text that really got my attention. And I saw them as twinned. I really saw the humor and the sort of anger and outrage braided together. And I realized that that really hadn't been written about before. And I was sort of amazed by that. And not so amazed then when I went to my professors and said I would like to do humor in women's novels. And they said, well, there is no humor in women's novels. And I was like, nay, I think you're wrong.
That's your whole career
wrong
right there.
About that. Yeah. And then I found that there was one other woman who has sadly passed away, but a woman named Nancy Walker, who was my senior, but just started about 5 years before I started my dissertation working on women's humor as a scholarly topic. But it was new. No one had actually theorized in terms of literary studies the idea of gender and humor. And so once the committee that I had said, oh, okay, go ahead. You know, we don't know what you're going to come up with, but we'll let you do it. I just had a great time. And so I did the dissertation, and then I got the job here at UConn. In the summer after my first year, I was busy trying to turn my dissertation into an academic book and desperate to get tenure. I mean, I, you know, had been a self-supporting student my whole life. I needed the job, and I wanted to keep the job. And so I was living in the Mansfield apartments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And before now, they look like, you know, Paris to me. But in those days, I mean, they're poured concrete walls, I mean, with linoleum floors, and like there was no air conditioning, and the walls would sweat. I was there in the summer.
They're not the most high-end.
They were not, yeah. And I was sitting on, like, really with a card table in the middle. I had no money. The card table in the middle and practically a naked light bulb over the card table. And I read a book review by a woman who was an editor, it turned out, at Penguin. And I sent her a note. In those days, we actually wrote things. I sent her a postcard and said, that was a really interesting review. I just wanted you to know that, because I think it's important to hear from writers, to hear if you've written something good from somebody. And she said, oh, we should have lunch. And in those days, the idea that someone would buy me lunch was, I continued to be a cheap date, but I was really a cheap date. And the idea of ordering, you know, by looking at the left-hand side of the menu before the right-hand side of the menu was a novelty. And so she liked the topic of women's humor. And she said, would you consider doing a trade book? And I said, well, I have to do this academic book. I have to get tenure. I need to turn this into this. This is what I'm working on now. And she said, we would pay you. And I said, I can do two books at the same time. I can do that. I actually did sit, and which one does when one's young, I did not sleep. And I wrote the book that became the scholarly book out of Wayne State University Press called Untamed and Unabashed, Essays on Women and Humor in Literature. And then for Penguin, Viking Penguin, did They Used to Call Me Snow White But I Drifted, Women's Strategic Use of Humor, which became a very popular best-selling book. And where instead of using examples from George Eliot and Jane Austen and Muriel Spark and Faye Weldon and Elizabeth Bowen, I used I Love Lucy and The Dating Game and That Girl and stand-up comics, Joy Behar, and the people who were around in the early 90s who I got to know pretty well. I went to a lot of comedy. And so doing those two simultaneously was exhausting, yeah, but really useful, because it got me thinking about both the scholarly sort of underpinnings and the sort of philosophical and academic underpinnings for the arguments, but then to really learn how to apply it in terms of people's real lives. And that was fun. And it was worth losing the sleep. And I now nap. I make up for those early years.
That's incredible. Who are your favorite comics or comedians?
Let's see. I just watched, so the first thing that comes off the top of my head, I just finished watching Wanda Sykes's Not Normal. She did it last year. I think it's a Netflix special now. And she's hilarious. She's been doing stuff for a long time, but I think she's in her 60s. And she has absolutely triumphed in this one. It is political, it's personal, her timing is perfect. She masters the stage. It was watching a virtuoso performance where I was just enthralled. I was so happy and laughing so much while she was telling the truth about everything. And again, just confronting race and confronting LGBT sort of stereotypes and medical care and politics and everything in a way that you don't feel like you were being lectured at all. She was just telling these personal stories. And then you realize by the end of it that you got a lesson in every important issue. And it was brilliant. I like sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. One of the guys on the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, Ron White.
Oh, I like Ron.
He's a favorite of mine. Maria Bamford. She did a Netflix special, or maybe if it was for Comedy Central, where, because again, she's got a mind like Robin Williams, right? I mean, that I can't imagine what goes, I think I can imagine what goes on. They're from a different galaxy, and
right.
I understand that, you know, they're Olympians where I'm, you know, walking in my basement treadmill, and they're coming in first with a gold medal. These people just, they amaze me and delight me, and I'm so happy to be able to watch them. And then I try to read the new people who are coming out. It's interesting. I think I'm more demanding of the writers.
The
I still like my co-author, Gene Weingarten, who won two Pulitzer Prizes, and I didn't, which was after Gene and I wrote a book together called I'm With Stupid, One Man, One Woman, and 10,000 Years of Misunderstanding Between the Sexes Cleared Right Up, based on a series of articles we'd written for the Washington Post. The book did well. The books have all been translated into different languages. It's really fun. So then Weingarten went and wrote another book and won the Pulitzer Prize, and then wrote another thing and won the Pulitzer Prize, and I didn't. And then I wrote a book called It's Not That I'm Bitter. Actually, it just called yesterday, and we did another column together that'll be out in the next couple of weeks. So so we still get to do that. We wrote that book over the phone and without ever having met. We met the day I'm With Stupid came out on Good Morning America. So it was really like the longest blind date. We spent 2 years doing the book together, and then we met. It was a lot of fun.
My last question is, what have you learned through all of this studying, teaching, writing that has kind of impacted your life or affected how you live your life?
That almost anything in the world that happens to you can make you either laugh or cry. That we're not going to go back to, you know, sort of Shakespeare's nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That choosing how to tell your story, how to look at your story, really is how we write the script of our lives. It's not that somehow to tell a funny story about a terrible thing that happened diminishes the importance of it, but it gives you control over it. It becomes your story as opposed to something that happened to you. I talk about this in my last book, which is If You Lean In, Will Men Just Look Down Your Blouse? One of my favorite things, I got the award from the Girl Scouts of Connecticut for storytelling, for writing. And I said I write in order to be able to tell the story so that it's not just a series of random things that have happened, but I get to be the narrator of what happens. I get to talk about what happens. So if there's something like depression, anxiety, both things that I've dealt with in my life and in my family, where you're talking about, you know, my complex relationship with my mother who died when I was very young, or any of the difficulties, or growing up poor, or having a struggle in the earlier part of my life, that telling those stories makes me not only examine them and understand them, and also be able in the best ways to help other people who are going through them, especially other women and my students who are going through difficulties where you feel like you're never going to be able to get outside the other end, to say, like, this is how you get outside the other end, and there is joy that can happen after this. And all comics, anybody who has dealt with comedy, understands that pain plus time equals humor. And that's because you do get a different perspective on it. But it's not to go back and undo what's happened, or, again, to trivialize what happens, but in order to put a frame around it so that you can look back and say, this was that moment, things have changed, this was what I learned from it, this is what benefited me, and this is who I am now because of that. And it's also a way to understand how not to repeat what you've done because you understand what happened, how to be able to move to another chapter where you're able to write a different script from the one that you were handed, and also to understand that sort of life is about improv, but improv also takes an enormous amount of discipline, and that being able to tell that story takes the kind of discipline that telling the story regularly and understanding how stories are told gives you. And that's why it's important to do it on a sort of a regular, ongoing basis, and also to listen to the stories that other people tell.